You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, are you guys familiar with a fellow named Raymond Dart?
No.
Yes.
No. So,
Dart is this little old man who discovered the Tong child, right, in Australopithecine. And
that's
it
right.
It was funny because he's like this sweet little old guy who then talks about how savage and horrible people are.
what nationality is he?
Australian. Australian.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
Okay.
Because it was on this date in 1925 that the first report of his find came out in the newspaper The Star of Johannesburg, South Africa. And it was actually sent into Nature magazine, and they were going to publish it there, but I guess the editors of the journal Nature had a change of heart for whatever reason. So today was the day it was officially introduced to the world.
Yeah, very, very important Australopithecine fossil. I believe there was, in fact, a bit of an endocast of the brain preserved with that fossil. Did we read anything about that, Evan?
The cast was found. Endocranial cast was found.
Yeah.
And which at first seemed to be another primate skull. Then Dart noticed how amazingly close to human it looked.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you were going to talk to us about an amazing fusion breakthrough, finally.
I was? All right, well, I didn't really do any research. I'll just ring it. I'll just wing this.
All right. Off the top of your head.
I'm actually very excited about this. I know I get excited about a lot of stuff.
That's why we love you, Bob.
I really, really mean it this time.
really, really. All those other times, man.
No, this is extremely cool. This could be a game changer, as they say. Scientists at the National Ignition Facility claim that they've overcome what appears to be the last major hurdle for the production of energy through sustained nuclear fusion. If this becomes commercially viable, they really can pull this off, then we could soon literally change the world with an energy source that's safe, it's carbon emission free. The source of the fuel is so abundant that it could literally last us for millions of years. Sound
right,
good?
So,
sounds like cold fusion.
Before we start cutting into it, tell us what the process is and all that.
Well, first, the National Ignition Facility. This is actually the facility that this huge, gargantuan machine that actually is doing this work, and this is at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. This is a fascinating collaboration, a national collaboration between industry, academia, and the U.S. government. So it's just, I think it really shows that what synergy you can get going between players like this. But what it does, its business is fusion. Basically, fusion is the power of the sun, or you could say the universe. What's happening is that at great temperatures and pressures, lighter elements fuse together to form a heavier nucleus, right? So you end up with a heavier nucleus, but you got a little bit of extra energy left over, but this energy is more than it takes to squish the atoms together. So you see how important that is. I know it sounds a little bit like free energy, but it's not free energy.
In fact, that sounds exactly like
it's physics.
Energy.
Actually, it does.
You're saying it's a byproduct of the fusion
right.
process,
right? And it makes sense when you consider E equals mc squared and the energy that's contained within the binding forces of the atomic nucleus. And so it's nothing fishy going on here. Actually, look at the sun, and you're looking at the byproducts of fusion right there. Actually, fusion is has the highest energy density than any other energy source that you could think of, with the exception of one, and that's matter, antimatter, annihilation.
Yeah,
we're not going to be seeing that in the near future, but we can see fusion in the near future. It's actually better than even fission in terms of energy density. But nuclear energy just by itself, whether it's fission or fusion, it's a million times more energetic than chemical energy, which is just burning, like we would say we would do with oil.
How much energy can they get out of it? What are they predicting?
All right, here's an example. The fuel pellet that would be ignited using this process that the National Ignition Facility, say the pellet's as big as a pinhead, real tiny. Normally, they wouldn't convert all of that to energy, but just for a comparison, if they could convert all of it, they could extract as much energy from a pinhead of this isotope of hydrogen equivalent to a barrel of oil. Or another way to think of it, Jay, is if you had 10 gallons of water, you know, the energy content of water in terms of the hydrogen in the water would be equivalent to the energy you could extract from a super tanker of oil.
Bob, how long before I have a Mr. Fusion in my flying DeLorean?
Yeah, that's a good question. Adam, this is such a fiendishly complex facility. I don't know what it's going to take to get this thing down to size, but that does matter. And some of the critics actually say that this could really hurt it because it's such an expensive facility that it's not going to be competitive.
But it could be a deal killer, right? If the thing costs billions of dollars, it may just not be worth it.
What company that has that kind of money wouldn't spend it to achieve that? I mean,
the thing is, though, once you've got a proof of concept, once they can do this, though, then you would build a test facility. And I've seen prices kicked around of maybe $1 billion, Steve, for a facility that you could prove that could really work. I don't know. I think it's too soon to say that. And this could be – they seem so close. And, I mean, they predict that they will get ignition. They will get an ignition later this year. They are like 90% of the way there. One of the things that they've overcome. They've actually, of course, overcome many different things in terms of the laser energy. People say that it'll never be powerful enough. Well, it seems like the lasers are powerful now. Actually, the laser that they've produced is 60 times more powerful than any other laser ever built.
What?
This is an incredibly powerful laser.
60 times?
Talking megajoules of energy per, you know, in fractions of a second, incredible energy, energy density, I think you would call it. But they've overcome the precise aiming problem because you have to precisely aim these lasers. I mean, they create a laser beam that's kind of split into 192 different laser beams that then impinge onto this fuel source, and that rapid heating of the fuel source is what condenses it, collapses it down into such temperatures and pressures that you've got fusion going on. But the problem is that there's a plasma that's created when the lasers impinge on the fuel source or whatever's around the fuel source. There's a plasma, you know, plasma field that is generated. Plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's kind of like a soup of a gas where the electrons are ripped away from the atom. So you got a soup of nucleons and electrons just floating around.
Soup.
So it's pretty nasty.
But
that's
tasty.
But tasty. But the problem was that the laser then interacts with this plasma, and everybody thought that interaction would cause lots of problems. Actually, these scientists took advantage of that, and they actually used the plasma to tune to interact with the laser in such a way that it makes the heating more uniform, which is actually absolutely key, because if there's uniform heating of the surface, then you've got a uniform compression, which will actually create the fusion events happening. This was like the last problem that they've overcome, and now it looks like it should be smooth sailing to an ignition event where they create a fusion that is self-sustaining.
So it's mainly going to be cost effectiveness then?
The biggest problem I've seen is this is actually a quote from Thomas Cochran. He's a senior scientist with the Natural Resource Defense Council. He's been tracking the National Ignition Facility for quite some time. He says that they're snake oil salesmen, which is kind of disheartening to hear such a negative attitude from this guy. But his other complaint here is that it's too big, too costly, and they'll never be competitive. That's the only critique I've heard that seems viable. But there are many people that disagree with him.
This is like the UNIVAC. I'm
hoping it is. And I think once later this year, when they show you that they actually can get more energy out than they put in, I think people will be like, holy crap.
That will definitely put us on track to having viable fusion factories, energy factories, or power plants. But it still doesn't mean that just the ability to create fusion does not equal a cost-effective power plant, because you not only have to consider the time to make back the investment, but what will the maintenance be? You know, if you might get to the point where you never pays for itself because the maintenance costs exceed what you're making back. And you
Absolutely.
Also have to consider not only the cost-effectiveness, but the energy effectiveness. How much energy does it take to build one of these power plants and maintain it, and operate it. And when does that get offset? How long does it take for the energy, that extra energy you're making, to offset that?
This this news wasn't put out by the Raelians, was it?
I hope they weren't involved.
Oh, those damn Raelians.
No, this one was put out by the Vorlons.
Sign prank.
The Vorlons.
Let's go on to some update on Andrew Wakefield. Now, Andrew Wakefield is the British researcher who first came out with the study in 1998, potentially linking the mumps, measles, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, with GI disorders and autism. The study itself has come under a great deal of criticism, both for questionable ethical behavior on the part of Wakefield, as well as poor science. In 2004, 10 of the 12 co-authors on the paper withdrew their names from the paper. They retracted their support for the paper. The primary motivation for that retraction, which is a partial retraction in 2004, was the discovery that Andrew Wakefield was receiving a significant amount of money from trial lawyers who were suing for alleged vaccine injuries. So he was basically being paid to show that there's a link between the MMR vaccine and autism.
There's also the discovery that he had applied for his own patent for his own competitive vaccine.
Yes. Right.
Surprise.
So we had actual conflicts of interest, massive conflicts of interest, not just the pseudo ones that people throw up there when they want to dismiss studies. So that was the cause for the original retraction in 2004. But the paper still was not retracted by The Lancet, the original publisher itself, and still was part of the medical record, you know, the medical literature. Mm-hmm. Since then, the story has gotten worse and worse and worse. Looks as if Wakefield was accused of, say, and he admitted to this, of paying children at his child's birthday party, like giving them £5 to have their blood drawn and be part of the study. He also was the subject of an investigative journalism by Brian Deer, who uncovered a lot of these shenanigans, as well as possible evidence of cherry picking the subjects of the study, you know, not doing them sequentially as was claimed in the study, and maybe even fabricating evidence. The raw data in the study does not match the hospital charts of the subjects of the study, for example. So very, very bad. This led to, and here we got he suffered a 1-2 punch this week. This led to an investigation by the General Medical Council, the GMC in the UK, which took a couple of years. And they did finally come out with their full report, in which they ruled that Andrew Wakefield acted, quote, dishonestly and irresponsibly in doing his research. They also concluded that he acted unethically and did not have the best interests of the children in his study in mind, which is a no-no. They still will decide on what to do about this. They basically said, yes, he's guilty, but they'll take a couple of months to figure out what to do. They can do what they call in the UK, strike him off the register of official physicians, of MDs.
Is that like having your license revoked?
Yes, it's like having your license revoked. They'll strike him off.
But he's here in the U.S.
But he's here in the U.S. practicing, so...
Lucky you.
Yeah, that won't...
yeah, thanks, Rebecca.
I guess you and your exports. And then I thought, oh, no, wait.
oh, no.
You know, also, though, another fallout of this was that on February 2nd, The Lancet, the original journal that published his paper, officially rejected it. Anyway, they went back and said, oh, yeah, you know what, that was a load of crap. Our bad.
So. Yeah, so finally, that was the two punch. After 12 years, The Lancet, you know, and in reaction to the GMC ruling, retracted the paper. What they wrote was that after explaining why, you know, that there were some problems with the science, not just the ethics of the paper, they concluded, therefore, we fully retract this paper from the published record. Very uncommon thing. Now, of course, you know, the age of autism and the anti-vax movement are all portraying this as a witch hunt.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, and a conspiracy. And this just makes him a martyr in their eyes. This just raises, you know, his profile in the anti-vax movement. But
The evidence against him is so damning. It's really disturbing to see people continue to line up behind him. It's so disturbing.
And he's probably wearing it as a badge of honor.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. He's not admitting anything. So, I mean, you know, again, we don't fault scientists for coming to conclusions which are later found to be false. That's okay. Most studies are wrong, right? In hindsight, you look back, most scientific results will turn out not to be true because, you know, that's just the nature of investigative science. What is at fault is the poor ethics and also his undisclosed conflicts of interest. And now sticking to the conclusions of his paper, despite now 12 years of science, which shows there is no link between MMR or any vaccine and autism or developmental disorders. The science has really contradicted everything that he claimed. His techniques were flawed. The PCR that he relied upon gave false positives. It's possible he knew that at the time.
What's that, Steve?
The PCR is a way of detecting very tiny amounts of DNA or RNA.
Polymerase chain reaction.
Yeah,
it amplifies all the material.
And that was used to detect the measles virus in the guts of the children in the study. But the lab that did it used poor technique, and those results were almost certainly false positives. Later studies could not replicate his results. They showed that the techniques were flawed. And Brian Deere believes that Wakefield knew that at the time. And published anyway, even though he knew the results were bad. And even if he didn't, it was every element of the science has been knocked down. Every element of the claim has been shown to be false. So, but he plugs away now, just becoming a champion of this false science that he really kicked off, leading to drops in compliance with the MMR vaccine, return of measles and mumps outbreaks in the UK, and now exporting that to the United States. But it's good to see that he is getting at least some comeuppance.
Yeah, my only response is what took him so long, but I'm glad it did it.
It would have been nice if they just did that in 2004, you know, when the concerns initially came to light. Evan, give us the quick follow-up on the return of Death Cat.
Okay, here's the quick follow-up. There was a book released last week. Mm-hmm. Guess by whom? Dr. David Dosa.
Oh.
Yes. He wrote a book about his death
Oscar.
Cat. And it's called Making Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat.
That's like, that book's like the Marley and Me for the most depressing set ever, because instead of the animal dying, it's all the people who touch it.
So to for those who don't recall, back in 2007, in an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine, right?
I've heard of that.
Dr. Dosa's article appeared in which he described this cat that this hospice home adopted. And the cat would have the uncanny sense of when people, right at the end of their lives, within a very few hours of the ends of their lives, this cat would go over to that patient and curl up beside them. And after many observations, apparently the cat was deemed to have some sort of sixth sense or what have you, in that it was able to predict which patients were the next to go.
It's the heartwarming story of the decade.
And they would try to put the cat next to people whom the doctors felt
wanted
might be
die.
Soon to go, and the cat didn't want anything to do with them. The cat would go off and go to someone else, and that someone else would apparently be the patient who would unfortunately pass away a few hours later. So
right.
this
I don't buy it for a minute.
No.
So it seems like a massive exercise in confirmation bias. You know, once you think you've made an observation, then it's very easy to notice when that observation seems to be confirmed, and you know, you explain away or ignore or dismiss the disconfirming evidence. This is now over years, and he says that 50 different incidents of the cat, quote-unquote, predicting the death of one of the patients at this facility. Now, it's not impossible that there is something about these patients that might attract the cat, and it's not physically impossible. They might be smelling something.
Heating blankets or something like that put on people who are about to die that might attract the cat.
Or they're just not moving, and the cat apparently likes that.
Yeah.
Dr. Dossi speculated maybe it's ketones from the breath of somebody who's in the process of dying. But that seems like that is something that could be tested. You know, you could actually measure to see if there are ketones, or just use that, you know, use ketones to see if it attracts the cat. So right now, we're not even sure it's a real phenomenon. If it is real, it's very highly speculative. There really isn't any scientific data here. It's just like a human interest story passing itself off as science. But
why do people love stories like this?
Why would you write a book about it? It sounds like he's trying to make it a nice, you know, fun. I mean, what is this book about? It sounds like
life affirming. It's life affirming, Rebecca.
It's the opposite of life. It's death affirming. It's death cat affirming.
like a raven or a buzzard showing up at your window.
Right?
I mean, how is that comforting, right? Oh, look. And for a doctor, an MD, a professor at Brown University, and the lack of science that he's using here, you know, in his explanations behind it, and, you know, his lack of data. He hasn't done any tests that anybody, you know, he's done no double-blinded experiments or anything to see if there's some kind of real phenomenon here. He ignores all that conveniently, and I guess it gets in the way of making pretty books that sell lots of copies.
One funny aside, in his interview, he mentioned that, well, yeah, there are dogs who can smell cancer. So I'm like, I better check that out, because I don't know if that's really been established. I looked at all the studies I could find looking at that, and there are some very preliminary studies, a lot of them published in like alternative medicine type journals that I don't think are very prestigious. And there's a couple that are negative, so the results are mixed. Could easily be a little bit of a file drawer effect going on, you know, just one or two other studies that were negative but nobody bothered to publish, and the literature would essentially be awash. So I'm not convinced that there are any dogs who can smell cancer either. But again, there's some plausibility there. You know, there certainly people with certain kinds of cancer can have different chemicals in their breath, and dogs certainly have sensitive enough smell to detect that. So it's not implausible. The science is just mixed and preliminary at this point, but that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and as a tangent to that, Steve, though, what they are doing is scientists are experimenting with things called electronic noses that can pick up the volatile molecules produced by cancer cells with greater accuracy than, well, you know, certainly humans, and at least, you know, when more so than dogs, because you can actually see what's actually going on with something like an electronic nose, series of computers.
It may not be more sensitive, but we can communicate it more directly.
More accurately, yes. We can see really what's going on. So I thought that was interesting.
My dog lost his artificial nose.
Oh. What?
Oh, come on, people. How does he smell?
Oh, Jesus.
Just forget it. You guys suck.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
All right. Why don't we get to it and play last week's Noisy for everyone? Here you go.
Money. Well, you know, something still doesn't add up, you know? You got your classic mystery here.
Yeah, it's right up there with crop circles.
You don't believe in anything. You don't believe in the afterlife?
Life would be easier if I were gullible.
Be careful.
I love that line. Life would be easier if I were gullible.
Yeah.
Anyone want to guess the title of this movie?
The Skeptic.
That's right. Did we talk about this last year? I don't recall that we actually talked about it. I don't know how we missed it. I mean, other than the fact that it's a terrible movie.
I didn't see it.
It was supposed to be terrible. I don't think anybody saw it.
Well, it got an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Did anybody
8%?
Get it right?
8%.
If so, that'll prove my point that nobody saw it. I mean,
it must have been a direct theatrical release. Was May 1, 2009. You know, I don't know in what country, but it wasn't the United States, I don't think. Here's the synopsis. Following the mysterious death of his aunt, power lawyer Brian Beckett moves into the elderly woman's purportedly haunted Victorian mansion. A die-hard skeptic, he dismisses one eerie incident after another, until the haunting turns so personal and vicious, Beckett's cool, unemotional veneer begins to unravel.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that just grip you?
Skeptic.
I mean, isn't that just what every skeptic is? You know, is
right.
Isn't that nice that this movie has taken the good name of skeptic and turned it into an 8% on Rotten Tomatoes? Well done. So, Yes, and there were several correct guesses, and the first one to get it correct from the message boards, Mobius.
Mobius.
Good job, Mobius.
And that was Mobius's third post.
We're sorry you had to watch that movie in order to get that answer.
What do you got for this week?
All right. This week, I tried, well, I didn't have to guess it, but I don't think I could have guessed this in a thousand years. So you guys have, you know, better part of a week to guess it. So here it comes.
That was right. In Return of the Jedi. That was the fight when the
you
have to be more specific.
When the good guys fought the bad guys.
Right? Yeah, remember that part?
It does sound like some kind of a cable being twanged.
It's not a cable being twanged.
Twanged?
I'll tell you, twanged, twittered. It's not that, so don't guess that.
Okay.
Let's do one quick email. This one comes from Jacqueline in Norwalk, Connecticut, and she writes, I heard something recently that I felt I just had to let you guys know about. I listen to a popular radio morning show in Minnesota despite living in Connecticut. Thanks to the internet, I can listen to it live online. A few weeks ago, one of the DJs of this popular morning show went off on a tangent about how Lady Gaga was a member of the Illuminati. That particular DJ is usually understood to be a bit of a conspiracy nut burger, so I merely laughed and thought nothing of it. That is, until a large number of people started calling and texting the radio station to say that they believed it as well. It became apparent that a lot of people believed that the Illuminati is real and that Lady Gaga is a part of that mass conspiracy. I did a little digging and found the primary articles which started the conspiracy theory. Unfortunately, it seems that a large number of people actually believe in this crap. My question is, could you guys please lay the skeptic smackdown on this incredibly inane conspiracy theory before a bunch of yahoos get all bent out of shape over something that doesn't exist? Thank you so much and keep up the amazing podcast. Well, actually, Jacqueline, I think what's going on here is that these guys have penetrated behind the veil.
Yeah, it looks pretty convincing to me.
Yeah, they've seen the hidden and subtle signs and symbolism in Lady Gaga's work that shows that she actually is a puppet mind slave of the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm. I mean, no one person could come up with songs that catchy.
That's right. If she is single-handedly changing the youth culture and enslaving them to the notion of superficiality
And consumerism. Poker faces.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, poker so that, face, right?
Just, she's definitely weakening them up for the ultimate Illuminati takeover of the world. Clearly, we can see that. Now, the most telling part is, now, of course, with these mass conspiracies, these grand conspiracies, they always have to tip their hand. It's like the monologuing that the evil guys do to the hero at the end. They always have to tell the secret behind their master plan. The Illuminati can't resist and to give out the secret clues of their secret influence. So, you know that one of the symbols of the Illuminati is the single eye, like the eye that's on the pyramid on the dollar bill. Yep. Yeah. So just look at all of Lady Gaga's videos and her pictures. How many times does she have one eye covered by her hair or by her hand or behind part of a wall? Clearly.
The answer is quite often.
Quite often. Quite. Clearly, what other explanation could there be for that than she is signaling her association with the Illuminati?
My favorite piece of evidence included in this article is a photo of Lady Gaga with a string of Christmas lights wrapped around her, and the caption underneath of it that the author has written is literally bound by the illuminated.
That is so clever.
Wow.
Wow.
It takes someone to point it out to you. For you to realize how obvious it is.
See, I wear Christmas lights in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I walk around; they're comfortable. I feel good when I wear them.
Right.
You know what? It's comments like that that show that if you're looking hard enough, you will find it.
That's right. Well, you have to look for it, though, Jay.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Nash having all those newspapers and strings in his office. You know, all connected. It's perfectly fine. It's a good way of going about figuring things out.
There's no sign of schizotypal mental illness in this at all. this hyper agency detection and pattern recognition and looking.
I'd like
for...
to read another photo caption, if I may.
Oh, sure.
She is wearing a Hello Kitty dress and posing in a very mannequin-like stance. Her hands are positioned in a way reminiscent of iconic art, which displays the hermetic maxim, as above, so below.
There you go. Well, she also is enamored of the butterfly, which is one of the symbols of the Illuminati, because it represents metamorphosis. Or
she
changing.
Did once wear a butterfly something or other.
Yes. Now, why else would a pop diva wear a butterfly hat except to signal her connection with the Illuminati? I don't know.
Right.
Yes.
Also, you know, while we're on the topic of Lady Gaga being in the Illuminati, I would just like to point out that Beyonce is a lizard person.
Mm-hmm. She's lizard.
She's a lizard person.
She's a reptilian is what you're saying.
Wait, are you saying she's a sleestack?
Not a sleestack.
Like President, Bush and
yeah, that would be
Hillary
a little
Clinton.
Crazy, wouldn't it?
Don't be absurd.
No, Bob, this is like the aliens from V.
Ah, I see.
No,
did you ever see her eat a live rodent?
I did see her unhinge her jaw once and swallow Jay-Z whole. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it, though.
Right. Well, thank goodness we have David Icke to warn us about the lizard people.
Icke.
I like Icke.
Let's see if I get an email about correcting C's pronunciation of David Icke.
Icky.
Concerning the Ayn Rand.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's bring up
you think
Ayn
that,
Rand again soon.
What does David Icke think about Ayn Rand? That's what I want to know.
Lizard.
Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Professor Simon Conway Morris. Professor Conway Morris, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Professor, you prefer Conway Morris or just Morris?
Well, thank you. My Christian name's Simon and my surname is Conway Morris. It's a little unusual in the American scenario, but it's just one of these foibles of Europe.
Right. So you are a professor of evolutionary paleobiology in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge. I believe it's fair to say you're best known for your work on the Burgess Shale and the Cambrian fauna. You were elected a fellow of the Royal Society at age 39 and the author of The Crucible of Creation, among other works. And thank you again for spending some time with us. You're, if I understand correctly, you were just coming from a meeting at the Royal Society, the focus of which was alien life. Is that correct?
That's correct, indeed, yes.
And what prompted me to ask you for this interview was a talk that you gave there about convergent evolution. Can you tell us about that talk?
Yes, effectively, the meeting in the Royal Society was what the implications of contact with extraterrestrials might be. And in large part, it's to revolving around the question, if we ever got a signal or indeed a visitation, what on earth would we do about it? But that was combined also with, of course, the remarkable rate of discovery of so-called extrasolar planets and the likelihood that planets approximately the size of the Earth will be detected really pretty shortly. And my contribution, for what it was worth, was simply to say that contrary to the general view, I think, that aliens will look, well, exactly alien, my suggestion is, in fact, that the biospheres on at least an Earth-like planet will really be similar, maybe remarkably similar to the biosphere we're familiar with. And, of course, so far as extraterrestrials with whom we might want to have a conversation, they themselves would also have many of the characteristics which we associate with humans. And as you might imagine, this is something which provokes a certain amount of controversy.
So what aspects do you think? Do you think they would be bipedal with heads on top of their bodies and five fingers? I mean, what aspects do you think would be similar to humans?
I think what one could say, first of all, is that it's, I think, important to remember that when we look at evolution on this planet, because there are so many different groups, we tend to, of course, to have specialists. And, of course, if you go to a museum, you have a specialist in one group and a specialist in another. And one of the tricks, I think, is to remind ourselves that organisms which can look very different actually often work in remarkably similar ways. I mean, to give you one instance, in certain cases when an octopus uses its arm to obtain a piece of food, it actually doesn't work as a flexible tentacle. It actually works as something astonishingly similar to the arm of a human. This is despite the fact that the anatomy of the octopus arm is really radically different. And this is actually quite an important example for two reasons. First of all, because it suggests that there are underlying principles of biological organization which will emerge even from very different starting points. But also in this particular paper, this is a paper in Nature some years ago, written by Sumbre and others, they also suggested that this might actually be the best solution. In other words, it's possible it's not possible to get anything more more efficient than what we see. So there's this background then that when people say, well, goodness me, look, is it going to have bipedal arrangement? Will it have five fingers? What I would suggest is that to begin with, the way in which the extraterrestrial will walk, and here, of course, we're talking about terrestrial animals, not aquatic animals, it would actually walk in very much the same way as we walk, but also, as it happens, very much the same way as a beetle walks. And there's an underappreciated similarity there. Correspondingly, I think it's got to have a nervous system, and I think there's got to be a concentration, and therefore it's going to have some sort of brain. It's going to sense the environment, and because the way in which the sensory systems have evolved on this planet and have repeatedly arrived at the same solution. So, for example, if you look at the way in which the insects smell their environment, it's remarkably similar to the way we do it as vertebrates. But in point of fact, we can show that they are independent. So all these lines of evidence suggest that we can look at biology through slightly different set of glasses now and not get so hung up about the history, though that's very important, but remind ourselves that there may actually be very efficient solutions which are very likely to evolve wherever you are.
So it sounds like what you're saying is there is convergent evolution, first of all, and that one of the forces that drives that convergence is optimality, that because evolution can explore so many different options, it's going to tend to settle upon an optimal solution to a common problem over and over again. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's correct. Now, of course, one's got to remind oneself that the biosphere we have around us is very diverse. And I'm certainly not suggesting for a moment that everything is, in a sense, trying to evolve towards being a human. What one wants to remember is that highly successful groups, which often form complex societies, will tend to rise to dominance, and they will tend to appropriate increasingly large amounts of the resources of that planet. And that's most obvious in the case of the humans, but of course one can see striking similarities in the organization of the ants and other groups of insects, which have what we call a eusocial organization. So that's correct. Now, one could always say, well, what's happening on this planet? Yes, it's not clear that the systems we have can really get much better. And there's a great deal of discussion amongst biologists with regard to whether these things are genuinely optimal. But one could always say, well, we're just stuck in a little local adaptive well, if you like. And elsewhere there might be very different arrangements. But what I find so striking about evolutionary convergence on this planet is that often in very distantly related groups, the same sort of solution arises. And this gives me some confidence that actually this is the way evolution is going to navigate to particular solutions on a repeated basis.
Right. And so there's also, like you bring up the example of the octopus and vertebrate eyes, and they certainly have many common features, which I would say are driven by physics, right? I mean, if you evolve in the same universe with the same laws of light and refraction and whatnot, that will drive some convergent evolution as well. But the details are certainly very different. I mean, the octopus and vertebrate retinas are reversed, you know, for example. So while overall broad brushstroke design may be convergent, the details will tend to vary.
That's absolutely correct, except that when you say the details, as we say, the devil is in the details, because famously, of course, the arrangement of the retina is the opposite way around to us in the octopus. And the reason for that is revolving around the embryology and the way in which the retina develops effectively from skin moving inwards, whereas, of course, our retina is an extension of our brain. But there are two things worth remembering about that, I think. The first is that, in principle, our retina is a bad design because, of course, there is a layer of cells above it through which the light has to pass, which is not what you see in the octopus. However, it turns out, in fact, that there are very clever ways in which the light is transmitted to the retina, which suggests that we suffer no disadvantage whatsoever. The other important aspect is, of course, that as our retina is an outgrowth of the brain, it actually works as part of the brain. It appears, I'm no expert in this area, but it appears that visual processing starts within the retina. Now, that doesn't occur in the octopus, but if you look immediately behind the retina of the octopus, there's an area of nervous tissue which does exactly the same thing. That is the processing of the visual information. So the point about this is you're absolutely correct that you could say, well, this is the physics of light, this is the physics of vision, that's perfectly fair. But on the other hand, one is closely related to an earthworm, that's the octopus, of course, and we're closely related to a starfish because we belong to a very interesting group of animals which include both the starfish and things like the Amphioxus animal. But again and again, when you begin to tease apart these apparent differences, the way in which the solution is arrived at in such things as the efficiency of making sure as much light as possible gets to where you want it to get, or the basis of the visual processing, hey presto, once again, the same solution is arrived at.
Yeah, but I can also see how it's also can be a matter of emphasis. I do have to take a little bit of an exception to the notion that there's no disadvantages to the arrangement of the vertebrae. I just by coincidence, I happen to have written an article about the diseases that are actually a consequence of the inverted retina, if you will, such as, you know, in diabetics and retinal hemorrhages and whatnot. There's lots of disease states that will impair vision in vertebrates that would not be a problem in the octopus, given that they have a more optimal arrangement. And the arrangement of the retina is an example of pure contingency. The reason why vertebrates have the retina one way and the octopus the other way. So I guess the point I'm leading to is, and this is where I guess you mentioned up front that this was a sort of there's some controversy surrounding these ideas. It seems to me the controversy is over the balance between contingency, historical contingency in evolution, and convergence driven by some underlying principle. What would you say about that?
Oh, I think that's perfectly fair. I mean, I for a moment wouldn't deny the roles of contingency, but I think they've been overplayed. And I could, for example, give you one example, or at least try and give it as an example, a very famous one, which is not directly to do with evolutionary convergence. But this, of course, is to do with the mass extinctions and the most famous example, which is the one which Stephen Jay Gould was very enthusiastic about, was, of course, to do with the disappearance of the dinosaurs. And as we know, 65 million years ago. And the point, of course, has been made that if the dinosaurs hadn't gone, then this would not have allowed the possibility for the mammals, amongst other groups, to radiate into these ecological possibilities. Now, there's all sorts of subtleties in this area, not least is the very large asteroid which certainly hit the Earth may not have been as influential as people thought. There's arguments about whether it's volcanism as well, and that needn't necessarily detain us. The fact of the matter is that the dinosaurs went rather quickly, and therefore the mammals and the birds were able to radiate. Now, I think historically that's absolutely correct, but my argument would be that actually in the broader scope of things, and I think that's really where the emphasis lies, are you interested in the nitty-gritty day-by-day detail, which is a perfectly fair way of looking at biology, or are you looking at the broader picture? Are you trying to find the predictabilities, which, of course, I suppose is what all science would like to do? Now, in this particular case, what I'd suggest is let's imagine that for whatever reason, the dinosaurs didn't go extinct. Either they survived a mass extinction or the asteroid missed, whatever your favorite scenario is. I don't think this would make any long-term difference at all for the following reason. We know that coexisting with the dinosaurs, of course, in the Cretaceous were, and probably beforehand, were the birds and the mammals. And the birds were already radiating very rapidly. There's some evidence the mammals were also beginning to radiate. And I think effectively what would have happened is that there were later environmental challenges which would have been the evolutionary spur for the radiation of the mammals. I'm thinking particularly of the global cooling and the glaciations and so forth. And the fact of the matter is, of course, that apart from the from from the observation that birds are just feathered dinosaurs. Birds and mammals are warm-blooded. They tend to have larger brains. They've independently evolved tool-making and, arguably, in the birds, even a form of technology. And once you're going to move into this sort of biological program, then large lumbering animals are going to be endangered. They are basically a walking larder. And I suspect, in fact, the really interesting thing about mass extinctions, and this is something which I don't think has been thoroughly tested, is that it actually buys you evolutionary time. I suspect that in the longer term, actually mass extinctions do not radically re-divert where evolution can go, because apart from anything else, if we look at the five great mass extinctions, which have happened since the Cambrian, three of them, really not a great deal happens on either side. If you look at the late Ordovician, if you look in the late Devonian, if you look in the late Triassic, sure, there's mayhem during the mass extinction, but overall, the differences either side of that event are not so significant. So this, if you like, again, it's not to say that, you know, contingency isn't a role, and you can take it at one level, and it's very interesting, but what about the bigger picture?
So you think that even if there weren't quirky mass extinctions because of, you know, volcanism or an asteroid hit, that although the timing may have been different, the broad sweep of evolutionary history would have still headed in the same direction. Mammals and birds would still dominate at some point in the Earth's future, if not today, then 100 million years from now, if it weren't for the asteroid that hit at Chicxulub. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is. And in that particular case, as I say, this is the observation that they develop cognitive capacities which are approached by some reptiles today, and the monitor lizards are a particularly interesting example, but they are an approach to that arrangement. And I think what strikes me very much is that, although this again is a very controversial area, and once again Stephen Jay Gould is very much opposed to it, the idea that there is something which we can fairly call progress in evolution is something you can identify. This is not to deny the reality of bacteria, though we should remind ourselves that perhaps the bacteria today are living in a different world and therefore may show their own adaptations to this different world. My argument here is that, of course, you know, there are lots of twists and turns in the history of life. Why deny that? But what one is more interested to say is, as we've already discussed in outline, you know, are there really either very good solutions, if not optimal solutions? And equally important, how different is different? And how many ways can you do particular things? And here one could take many examples from agriculture, or one could take examples from the sensory system, or indeed locomotion, the sorts of things we've already alluded to.
Now, I understand that. So, and just to, if I can summarize a little bit, what you're saying is that, again, over the broad brushstrokes of time, there is a tendency towards greater complexity and towards greater optimality that maybe is a meta trend in evolutionary history, on top of the more contingent and quirky, you know, details of evolution that are taking various twists and turns at random, which is interesting. But whenever we have this discussion, this is a topic that we've discussed on our show before, we're always struck by the ultimate sense that we're laboring with one data point, with the history of life on Earth. And like when I read your writings, and then I read Gould, I mean, you both, in my opinion, put forward a compelling argument, and I'm left with the sense, well, how scientifically do we distinguish these two visions of evolutionary history, the emphasis on contingency, the emphasis on convergence? How can we test this? How can we test your ideas?
Well, thinking back to this recent meeting in the Royal Society, of course, the test will be the discovery of a extraterrestrial biosphere. And I would say in that context, in fact, first of all, what is rather striking, it seems, is that there is quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the extremes of the environment, and here we're thinking of things like pressure and temperature and salinity and tolerance to metals, and these are the things, of course, we associate with the so-called extremophiles. These are mostly bacteria, not exclusively, are actually, these limits have been reached by terrestrial organisms. There's a suggestion that actually the total habitation box of at least, well, this begs the question, doesn't it, but of something akin to terrestrial life, that is, with a cellular organization and a metabolism and a replication system, that habitation box may not be much larger than the one which has been filled here on Earth. There are, if you like, thought experiments you can do in one sense and another, and also just looking at the Earth as a whole in terms of the tolerance of the biosphere, to argue that, in fact, what we see here probably is pretty close to the limits of what we might see almost anywhere. The other point, though, which is very difficult, is unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, depending on your view of what extraterrestrials are actually like, we only have a data point, as you say, of one. But when we, for instance, see the parallel evolution of the marsupials, take a very well-known example, here, in a sense, you do have mini crucibles of evolution where, to some extent, these experiments can be rerun in a number of ways. There's, I think, a slightly different point, which is, I think, ultimately perhaps more interesting, though this, is again, is work in progress. Of course, we're all familiar with the importance of missing links, as we call them, and the classic example in the case of the dinosaurs and the birds is Archaeopteryx. So it's fine and large, and this is a wonderful story. But it now turns out that at least two other groups of theropod dinosaurs took to the air independently of Archaeopteryx. So to begin with, when you have what we in the trade call a clade, that is an assembly of species which share a common ancestor, then it actually turns out that invariably various tricks will be reinvented again and again and again. And so one should not actually be particularly surprised, because after all, theropods have feather-like structures. Theropods tend to be fairly small in many cases. And of course, they are bipedal, which means that they freed up their arms as wings. So again, there's more complications than that. What I find so fascinating, of course, is that if you then look at the dinosaurs as a whole, if that's fine and large, the theropods are just one group of dinosaurs, there's lots of wonderful stories to be told about them. But if you go into the preceding geological interval, which we call the Triassic, of course, there's another group of reptiles which are preceding the dinosaurs. But it's now turning out that they show all sorts of convergences with the dinosaurs. In fact, they were so similar they were thought to be dinosaurs until the complete skeletons began to become available. And the most fascinating thing here is here in the Triassic, amongst this group of more primitive reptiles, there's something which is busy evolving towards something which looks just like a theropod. So the point here, I think, is that one gets the sense that the morphological spaces which are available for occupation are surprisingly limited. And then what's so fascinating, at least to my way of thinking, is that one is invited to inquire how far down the tree of life does this process go. In other words, are there particular transitions in evolution, like the invention of the eukaryotic cell, or mouse cellularity, or the nervous system, which of course have immense implications for subsequent evolution, but are themselves actually genuinely fortuitous. They really are the flukes of life, which I think Stephen Jay Gould would have appreciated. And once again, my suggestion is that, in fact, these are not flukes of life. These two are inevitabilities.
But you can also find, and again, I know Gould specifically argued, more counterexamples. So, like, for example, if you compare the mammalian fauna of Australia with North America or Europe, yes, there are examples of convergence, like with the Tasmanian wolf and the marsupial mole, for example. But there's actually more examples of creatures that are really very different, like kangaroos, and don't really have any analog on other continents. And you talked about convergence on, say, a theropod dinosaur form. But sure, but that was within already a sort of a narrow group of reptiles. And we certainly don't have anything today, like, for example, that's converging on a theropod. There are animals like, you know, say the big cats that are filling a similar niche, but have found a different morphology to meet the same kinds of demands of that niche.
You're absolutely right. Of course, there are kangaroos, but it turns out that hopping mammals of various sorts have evolved independently a number of times. I mean, they're not the size of kangaroos, but hopping around is by no means unusual, and it's certainly evolved for all intents and purposes independently. Another point about the marsupial comparison, indeed any other sort of comparison, is not for a moment what I want to say that this is a one-to-one identity. What I'm fundamentally interested in is, are there particular biological arrangements which rise to dominance in the way that they really, in a sense, take over the entire world? And I think one can see striking examples of that in the evolution of different sensory systems, for example. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one is, you know, one doesn't want to sound patronizing about this, but, of course, you're allowed, you know, all the things which naturalists love, all the sort of, you know, these fascinating little facts. It is worth remembering, though, that, of course, Australia itself is an interesting continent in as much in some respects it's a difficult continent to live on. And if we look at the marsupial radiations in South America, of which the great majority are extinct, of course, there's this very famous example of the saber-tooth, so-called Phylacosanelid, which is a saber-tooth marsupial, which is really very similar indeed to the placental saber-tooth cats.
Basically, there are high probability optimality solutions out there that are going to be hit upon over and over again. And so I definitely buy that. There's a certain amount of convergence in evolution because of the notion of attractors, of optimality, of physics, just probability. But, of course, also there's a certain amount of contingency. And I agree that the test is going to be when we find other ecosystems, maybe computer simulations. Who knows how sophisticated they will get. But do you think, other than those things that I mentioned, and I am referring in part to some articles that you've written about materialism as an ultimate explanation for nature, do you think there's something else going on too in evolution and in nature that is driving convergence and these longer patterns in evolution, or is it really, can it just be explained by physics and probability?
Well, I think one might say scientists as a whole generally suspect there's more than meets the eye to everything they do. In other words, you know, there's a sort of regressive investigation. And I think that's fairly clear in physics with regard to, you know, what puzzles us at the moment with regard to quantum effects. And like many, they can be observed, they can be beautifully measured, but quite what they mean is another question. And in the case of evolution, what I would suggest is that, of course, obviously I have no quarrel with the reality of evolution, nor indeed the way in which Darwin formulated his brilliant series of ideas, or indeed the importance of natural selection, where I might sort of draw a small question mark is to say, is that the end of the story? And, you know, the notion of something like an attractor, whereby certain morphological forms tend to fall out. And we also know, of course, that certainly at some levels of biological organization, there is self-organization. One sees that in some aspects of protein structure, for example. And, of course, you are then entitled to say, well, where does that self-organization come from? It doesn't come from nothing. It must have the basis of something else, I suppose. But in the very broader context, what I would like to try and demonstrate, I may fail, of course, that would be perfectly legitimate. Most of science in the end is a failure because, of course, you know, the hypotheses are superseded by ideas which are more embracing. Is that indeed, evolution is strongly predictable? That may or may not turn out to be the case. But also, of course, to inquire whether, in fact, there is, for want of a better word, a landscape across which evolution is forced to navigate. And I think one of the crucial areas, and this is extremely controversial, and one completely understands that many people will say there just is not a problem here, but I think there is a real problem, is to do with the nature of consciousness and this general area. Now, of course, as soon as we stumble into this area, it doesn't necessarily become polarized, but of course there are many very distinguished scientists who just don't think there's a problem at all. It's basically been sorted out. And I would suggest that may be premature. And it, in the end, gets to a sort of philosophy. But if I can give you one example, which may or may not persuade some listeners, to the effect, of course, one of the fascinating things is the way in which we see this convergence between the olfactory mechanisms in insects, well, notably Drosophila, of course, and ourselves. And it turns out the basic arrangement is almost identical, but it's clearly evolved independently. And most fascinating of all, in fact, very oddly, the transduction proteins which the insect uses have recently been shown to have a completely separate origin from the ones which are routinely used, which are G-coupled protein receptors like opsins. It's completely mysterious why they've had to reinvent the wheel, but evidently they have. But of course the point here is that although our olfactory repertoire is relatively impoverished, and there are fascinating evolutionary arguments why that might be the case in comparison to many other mammals. The fact of the matter is we have a reasonably acute sense of smell, so there we are. I'm chopping up garlic at home, going to prepare the dinner, smell the garlic, and I can describe in intense detail all the things which happen which lead to that thing eventually sending a signal to the brain. But there, inside one's brain, there is this qualia of the smell of garlic. And this is the classic philosophical problem, is are we actually making sense of the world around us? In other words, are these just inventions of a nervous system, or are they actually representing some sort of reality?
Would you consider yourself a dualist?
No. nice try, as we say.
I'm just trying to clarify.
No. You shouldn't. And it's a very, I find it's a very difficult area to talk about because I'm not a trained philosopher, but I regard our consciousness as being entirely embodied. That is, you know, it's within ourselves. But I've suggested in outline, and this too isn't by no means a novel idea, that, and this is speaking extremely metaphorically, and again, I can see that many people regard these ideas as simply absurd, but to the effect that our consciousness will not be explained using our current knowledge of biology, and that, speaking extremely crudely, one could envisage the brain being more like a sort of antenna. And a friend of mine who's a philosopher provided a sort of analogy to this and reminded me, of course, that, you know, if one has one's head chopped off, of course, you know, it's evident that one is no longer conscious. But in the same way as when you turn a radio off, that doesn't necessarily mean that the transmitter isn't continuing to work. Now, that is an extremely crude analogy, but it ultimately touches on both this question of where is this consciousness, because Darwin, of course, struggled with this idea. Is it just a secretion of the brain? I don't think so. But it then leads on to other areas which are actually, I think, relevant to science, which revolve around, well, you know, first of all, how are we so good at making sense of the world around us? We take it for granted, but how are we able to end up with these remarkable mathematical abstractions in particular, which really work? How are we able to begin to understand some aspects about the quantum world, which have, as other people have pointed out, so far as we know, no particular adaptive advantage? And again, we mentioned him several times in the past, but I think that shows his fertility of engagement. Stephen Jay Gould, I think, would have said, well, all this is just one of these famous spandrels. This is just a side product. If you happen to get a brain of a certain size and a certain organization, then these things will sort of, if you like, come free for nothing, but don't themselves have any adaptive advantage. But I think that when you look at the way science works and the way scientists work, by and large, we know that there's a great deal of sort of fumbling around. One's often pursuing, you know, the lines of inquiry which turn out to be completely useless. But, you know, year by year, one does learn more and more, and previously unrelated facts suddenly click together. And I don't think this is accidental. I think the world is organized in a very canny sense, and I think our ability to know that is not an accident.
If I can get back just a second to the antenna idea, because, again, not to quibble about terminology, but that's actually an analogy that has been put forward by dualists. The sense there then is that there is some, that the consciousness is coming from somewhere else and is being channeled to the brain, but the brain is not creating the consciousness itself. Is that what you're trying to get at?
I mean, you put it more clearly than I have, and all I can say is yes, that this is with no disrespect, but yes, crudely, that's what I'm envisaging. And you know, obviously one can see the incredulity in some people's faces. That's fair enough. But despite the many claims that consciousness has been explained, as I've observed at a number of meetings, with great respect, it doesn't seem to be that the Nobel committee has yet realized this. And it seems to me that there might be something more to be dealt with.
Oh, I certainly agree that we have a lot to learn about exactly how the brain creates consciousness, although I would argue, and I have argued, that that's different from knowing whether or not the brain is, in fact, the thing that's creating consciousness.
I fight very clear of any God of the Gaps arguments completely, because effectively, from the scientific perspective, I would argue that, in fact, probably, first of all, just as a scientist, it's what we don't know rather than what we do know, which is fundamentally interesting. And I think that's sometimes forgotten when we're trying to encourage young people to do science. I mean, obviously, you can't say, well, because I don't know very much, then maybe you won't know very much either. But I think know, it's sort of the curiosity and the thirst for knowledge, which is so important for so many of us. But more importantly, I just suspect, again, it's an intuition, no more than that, but I suspect we hardly know anything at all. I mean, clearly we've learned a great deal in the last, well, actually 400 years, effectively, if you go back to the medieval Paris and Oxford when physics first started. But nevertheless, you know, I wonder whether, you know, how many more surprises are around the corner. And I think that may well apply to consciousness. I think it's fairly clear it applies to some areas of physics. And of course, there are other explanations, but rather wickedly, you know, one points out that the astronomers have just lost about 85% of the visible universe. And no doubt it'll turn up at some point in some form or fashion. At least we very much hope it will. But the aspects here are that, it would be nice to think there might be some deep interconnections between these things in the way that Roger Penrose has argued, for example. But it's not to be too embarrassed by the fact that apparently sort of satisfactory explanations may look much more wobbly than we realize. But in no way at all am I saying, you know, that there's going to have to be some special agent there which allows God to intervene and say, oh, right, I'll help you through this small difficulty, because it couldn't be done any other way. It is much more that, you know, the universe in the general sense is a much more peculiar, as other people have said, a much stranger place, a much more wonderful place, in fact, than sometimes we give it credit for. Not you and me, and I'm sure the great majority of people who listen, but I do sometimes wonder whether it's a little bit of complacency.
Professor Conway Morris, thank you for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious. Is everyone ready for this week?
So ready.
All right, here we go. Item number one, research finds that despite cultural factors, left-handed people have higher self-esteem on average. Item number two, a new study finds that excessive internet use is associated with a higher risk of depression. And item number three, new research contradicts the 80-year-old notion of a primordial soup as the origin of life. Evan, go first.
Okay, so research finds despite cultural factors, left-handed people have higher self-esteem on average. I think that one's true. And then the study finding that excessive internet use is associated with a higher risk of depression. I don't know how they can determine that. Is that causation and correlation going on there? I don't know. The last one is new research contradicting the 80-year-old notion of a primordial soup. I don't know. I have no idea about that one. I'll say the internet use one and higher risk of depression is fact, and that leaves primordial soup must be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I'll start with three, the primordial soup. Wow, that's very interesting. Although I could kind of see that they might have come up with something that kind of steers the theory away from the idea of a primordial soup with organic molecules and like in the ocean. Maybe it's like they found something that points it towards it, maybe life starting in another medium, maybe like a some sort of clay, or even maybe deep sea vent or something. The energy source there is pretty intense. But the second one here makes excessively use the internet that maybe you would also be prone to a higher risk of depression. It doesn't make much sense to me about left-handed people having higher self-esteem, so I'm going to say that is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
The only one I'm pretty sure I get excessive internet use being associated with higher risk of depression. But I tend to use the internet a lot more when I'm just in a depressive mood. I just want everyone to go away, and I'll spend 3 hours clicking links in Wikipedia. So I think that's true. And I think that new research does, in fact, contradict the 80-year-old notion of primordial soup. Yeah, that leaves the left-handed thing. I think that left-handed people don't have higher self-esteem on average. That's kind of bizarre. I think that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Okay, so research finds that despite cultural factors, left-handed people have higher self-esteem on average. Yeah, I'm left-handed, and I don't know if I have higher self-esteem, but then, you know, that's only one one test case. Yeah, I agree with what Rebecca said about that. That seems kind of BS. The other one, a new study finds that excessive internet use is associated with a higher risk of depression. I can agree with that. New research contradicts the 80-year-old notion of a primordial soup as the origin of life. Yeah, okay, I'm going to go with Rebecca's idea and say that the left-handed thing is false.
Okay, so you all agree with number three, that new research contradicts the 80-year-old notion of a primordial soup as the origin of life. And that one is science.
Science.
Bob, did you read that one?
Cool. Yeah, actually I did.
Yeah, you were a little bit too spot on there.
I couldn't give it away. Oh, wait, that's... Never mind. That surprised you?
No, but, you know, just one.
Yeah, I did.
The vents with the energy, that's pretty, you know. So, yeah, that's basically what the study was looking at. So the notion of the primordial soup, remember when Carl Sagan said that, the primordial soup?
Emphasis on the popping pee.
Essentially, the oceans are filled with all these organic molecules, and that's where the first, organic chemistry took place, leading to the first cells. Now, the problem with that is that it's not clear exactly where the energy source would come from. You could still have these chemical reactions taking place exceedingly slowly. They would still occur at a certain rate, but energy would make them go faster. One potential source would be UV radiation shining down on the water.
What about lightning?
Yeah. Or lightning has been proposed as an alternate as well. That's correct.
Frankenstein.
However, a new study proposes an alternate hypothesis that the energy that was driving the original formation of the first cells was chemical energy from deep sea vents.
Oh.
Oh, like
very cool.
Hypothesis. And the part of the reason for this is that the same type of process that you would get is still used by cells today. So he says it makes sense that this sort of chemical gradient and a process called chemiosmosis, basically they're using this proton gradient that exists in the water, I guess, across these vents to create ATP. And ATP, the adenosine triphosphate, that's the energy currency of all living things. Use that to do the stuff of life. And then eventually cells figured out a way to make their own proton gradient by consuming stuff or by using ultraviolet radiation directly and make energy for themselves.
Hmm. There it is.
So then the first life then would be chemosynthetic as opposed to photosynthetic life then?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, right. That certainly sounds like a completely plausible hypothesis. Let's go on to number two. A new study finds that excessive internet use is associated with a higher risk of depression. Evan, you thought that one was the fiction. Everyone else thought that one was science. And that one is science.
I actually thought the soup was the science. It was the fiction. So.
Oh, you
but
did?
That's okay, yes.
Oh, sorry. And it was, you got one of the, it was one of the wrong ones. So, and this was a correlational study. The discussion of it makes it sound like that internet use causes depression, but I'm not sure that I buy that. They just found that higher incidence of moderate to severe depression among those that were met the criteria in this study for a quote-unquote internet addict than non-addicted users. However, it's certainly plausible that people who are depressed may go online to engage in online communities and do other things as it may be a way of dealing with their depression. So the cause and effect may go the other way. Or it may just be something about the personality type and not really be a cause and effect either way. Any comments on the peanut gallery?
Nope.
Nope.
Get the one.
Which means that...
And therefore...
Get to it, man.
Which means that research finds that despite cultural factors, left-handed people have higher self-esteem on average, and that one is fiction.
Fiction!
Woohoo!
In fact, if anything, left-handed people have lower self-esteem, which may stem from the fact that they're living in a right-handed world. And there's also a lot of cultural belief about things that are left or left-handed are sinister and evil and bad.
Oh, yeah.
There was research, however, that looking at left and right-handed people, psychological studies to see what preference they have or what do they associate goodness with. The right or the left side. And what they found was that left-handed people associate left-handed stuff or things that are on the left-hand side as being better and nice and good, just like right-handed people do with things that are on the right-hand side in roughly equal proportions. So it seems to be determined by their handedness and not by cultural beliefs or cultural pressures. Jay, do you feel biased towards things on the left-hand side of the world?
I was thinking of that when you said it. No, because being a left-hand person growing up in a right-handed world, you just adjust. And a lot of left-handed people become somewhat ambidextrous because of that.
Sometimes they're forced to write with their right-hand side, even when they're left-handed. So they become pseudo-ambidextrous. But also there actually is more – people who are left-handed have a higher are left-handed dominant for writing, let's say, have a higher incidence of being ambidextrous than right-handed people.
Yeah, I'm definitely – definitely way more ambidextrous than your average right-handed person. And I mix and match stuff too. Like, you know, I play some sports lefty and some sports righty, and I can do a lot of things with both hands. Like, you know, use the mouse with both hands. And
at least you drive on the correct side of the road.
Hey,
you would be amazed at how fast you get used to driving on the other side of the road.
Yeah, whatever. Try being on a bicycle.
Yeah, you gotta be careful. It's very risky.
That's what my day is like.
Oh, great.
Jay.
Left-handed.
Yeah. Yes. Regale us with a skeptical quote.
I would love to. This quote was lovingly found for me by Elena Scott, who is a game programmer living in California. And the quote is from Delos McCown, D-E-L-O-S, and the last name is M-C-K-O-W-N. I challenge you at home to pronounce that correctly. The quote is, "The invisible and the non-existent look very much alike." Delos B. McCown!
I really like that quote, actually.
I love it.
That's a point that I've made before, not quite so pithy, that when people come up with the elaborate special pleading as to why their phenomenon is invisible to science, it's like, oh, by coincidence, it has all the properties necessary to make it look exactly like something which doesn't exist.
Yep.
Right.
It's the invisible dragon story.
Yeah, right.
Steve, wait, I'm sorry. The person that sent the quote to me, the deal was she'd exchange the quote for me yelling her name, so I have to yell her name.
That's too bad.
Oh.
No?
Wait, we don't make deals like that, do we?
They're going to let me do
it? That's extortion.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Think we can do
can't
that.
Take bribes.
Elena Scott.
How was that?
That was soft.
Okay, you're so quick.
Do I have one announcement? The Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism for 2010, NexusCon 2010, April 17th, which is a Saturday. We're doing the same basic format that we did last year. Is now open for registration. We have our
Great.
Speakers list is almost finalized, but we definitely have DJ Grothy is going to be giving the keynote. Jamie Ian Swiss will be emceeing. We have James Randi confirmed, George Hrab, Steve Mirsky, David Gorski, Val Jones, John Snyder, Kimball Atwood, and of course the SGU crew.
Yay.
There may be one or two additions to that as well, but those are the people we have locked in at this point in time. And again, registration is open on the website, necsscon.org. Seating is limited, so don't get blocked out. Last year, we did sell out. We did sell out last year. So
fast, yes.
If you want to make sure you can come to New York to see us, get your tickets early. Okay, yep. And a quick reminder, the Rogues Gallery is up and functioning again and fully functional, and we're posting daily blog posts there, so check us out. The official blog of the SGU. And if you're not already reading our blogs, you can check out our many other blogs, which include Neurological Blog, which is on the NEST site, in addition to the Rogues Gallery, sciencebasedmedicine.org. I also contribute to Skeptic Blog, and Rebecca, of course, runs the Skeptic Blog. So lots of blogging going on.
We do have a lot of blogs.
So thank you all for joining me again this week.
Oh, thank
you. It
was
fun to be to you. Yes.
Our pleasure.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptic.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.